Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it's showtime. My name is John Horrigan, and it's great to be here at the River Bay Club here in Quincy. Tonight, Glenn Miller is missing. You're saying, who is this guy? Well, I call myself an old New England folklorist. I've been called a historical raconteur, a rogue nostalgian, an infotainer, born from Google Books and PowerPoint, and other rude monikers that I will not mention tonight. I specialize in what I call the new popular public history, which is bringing a contemporary and invigorating view to American history. My website is www.ushistory.me. But I specialize in historical events in the early 20th century up until World War II. I've collected a lot of historical accounts of weather in North America, so I'm a historical meteorological specialist. And I also research historical astronomy and historical fires and, in this day and age, historical economics. I have an interest in Irish history, the Revolutionary War, historical aviation, battle anomalies, unexplained phenomena, and tonight, mysterious disappearances. I belong to the Waltham Historical Society, the Watertown Historical Society. I'm a colonial reenactor with the Lincoln Minutemen, which means I dress up like a colonial soldier and I march in parades. And I'm a member of the Economic History Association, the Economic Historical Society, the Planetary Society, and my favorite is the Society in Dedham for the Apprehension of Horse Thieves, celebrating 200 years. And I apologize in advance if I break out into my sports announcer voice like I already have. That's because I am a professional sports announcer with the Boston Bruins alumni. I'm their hockey announcer. And with the New England Patriots alumni, I'm their basketball announcer for football players. And I also organize something known as the New England History Festival, which is in Watertown. I call it Historapalooza. It's coming to Watertown on November 13th. So my axiom, especially when unfortunately, you're way too young to remember Glenn Miller here tonight, which is unfortunate, but if by chance there is somebody that was around during that time, there's always somebody in attendance who knows more about the subject than I do, and of course, someone who thinks that they know more about the subject than I do. So in this case, I think that the general populace here tonight knows more about Glenn Miller than I do. So I'm here to learn as well. And I ask that you give me your personal recollections at the conclusion of my talk tonight. So we're going to look at his childhood, his adolescence, the birth of a musician, the early freelance years, discovered, early hits, superstar, duty calls, lost, and theories about his lost. What about Glenn Miller? Well, he was born Alton Glenn Miller on March 1st, 1904, and he went missing on December 15th, 1944, the age of 40. He was an American jazz musician, arranger, composer, and band leader in the swing era. He was one of the best-selling recording artists from 1939 to 1943, leading one of the best-known big bands in the world. He was born on a farm in Clarinda, Iowa, to Mattie Lou Cavender and Louis Elmer Miller. He went to grade school in North Platte in western Nebraska. One day, his father brought him home a mandolin. Glenn promptly traded it for an old battered horn, which he practiced every chance he got. His mother worried, it got to where Pop and I used to wonder if he'd ever amount to anything. In 1915, Miller's family moved to Grant City, Missouri. Glenn saved his money from milking cows to buy his first trombone and played in the town orchestra. Adolescence. In 1918, the Miller family moved again, this time to Fort Morgan, Colorado, where Miller went to high school. During his senior year, Miller became very interested in a new style of music called dance band music. He was so taken with it that he formed his own band with some classmates. And then on to college. By the time Miller graduated from high school in 1921, he had decided that he wanted to become a professional musician. In 1923, Miller entered the University of Colorado at Boulder, but spent most of his time away from school, attending auditions and playing in any gigs that he could get, most notably with Boyd Center's band in Denver. He dropped out of school after failing 3 out of 5 classes in one semester and decided to concentrate on making a career as a professional musician. It always happens that way. He later studied what's known as the Schillinger technique with Joseph Schillinger, under whose tutelage he composed what became his signature theme, Moonlight Serenade. In 1926, Glenn Miller toured with several groups, eventually landing a good spot in Ben Pollock's group in Los Angeles. Here's Ben. During his stint with Pollock, Miller wrote several musical arrangements of his own. You know that guy, right? He also co-wrote his first composition, Room 1411, written with Benny Goodman. During the late 1920s and early 1930s, Miller managed to earn a living working as a freelance trombonist in several bands. On March 21st, 1928, Victor Session Miller played alongside Tommy Dorsey, Benny Goodman, and Joe Venuti at the All-Star Orchestra, directed by Nat Shilkret. Dorsey, Goodman, Joe Venuti, and Nat Shilkret. On November 14, 1929, an original vocalist named Red McKenzie hired Glenn to play on two records that are now considered to be jazz classics, Hello Lola and If I Could Be With You 1 Hour Tonight. Here's Red. In 1928, when the band arrived in New York City, he sent for and then married his college sweetheart, Helen Berger. He was a member of Red Nichols Orchestra in 1930, and because of Nichols, Miller played in the pit bands of two Broadway shows, Strike Up the Band and Girl Crazy, where his bandmates included big band giants Benny Goodman and, to your right there, Gene Krupa. Come on in, folks. But he, like any musician, was a struggling artist. Beside Glenn were clarinetist Pee Wee Russell, guitarist Eddie Condon, drummer Gene Krupa, and Coleman Hawkins on tenor saxophone. Payroll records in the Nathaniel Shilkret archives also show Glenn playing on two Shilkret radio broadcasts in 1931, on October 9th on a broadcast sponsored by the Smith Brothers, and on November 21st on the Chesterfield Quarter Hour Show, Music That Satisfies. Anybody know who these people are?
Dorsey Brothers.
Dorsey Brothers. In early to mid-1930s, Miller also worked as a trombonist and arranger in the Dorsey Brothers Band, first when they were a Brunswick studio group, and finally when they formed an ill-fated co-led touring and recording orchestra. As musical director for them, he met a young Bing Crosby. Miller composed the song Annie's Cousin Fanny and Dee's Dem Does for the Dorsey Brothers Band in 1934 and 1935. There's Bing. Do you need more chairs? Okay. We're going to take a time out here. Let me... I have some chairs here. I'm not used to playing sold-out houses. Okay, let me... That's fine. Okay. Sir, would you like a chair? Am I blocking? Okay. Anybody else need a chair? It's like the Red Sox game. Can't find a seat. It's right here. Okay. Good chair right here. There you go. But.
I heard you.
Thank you, Lisa.
He's speaking.
So the idea of band. In 1935, Glenn Miller assembled an American orchestra for the British bandleader Ray Noble, developing the arrangement of lead clarinet over four saxophones that eventually became the sonic keynote of his own big band. That's Ray Noble. Members of the Noble Band include future band leaders Claude Thornhill, Bud Freeman, Pee Wee Irwin, Johnny Mintz, George Van Epps, Delmar Kaplan, and Charlie Spivak. Spivak. Here are some of the guys that I just mentioned: Claude Thornhill, Bud Freeman, Pee Wee Irwin, Johnny Mintz, George Van Epps, Delmar Kaplan, and Charlie Spivak. See, I tell you how to learn. There's Charlie. In 1935, Glenn began recording under his own name for Columbia Records, and his instrumental Solo Hop reached the top 10. So we have the first Glenn Miller recordings. In April 1935, while Glenn was recording for the first time under his own name, he used six horns, a rhythm section, and a string quartet. At that session, he recorded Moonlight on the Ganges and a blues serenade for Columbia. It only sold a few hundred records, so he continued his position with the Noble Orchestra. Anybody know who those are?
Gracie
and yeah, you got it. Well, Glenn Miller made his first movie appearance in the 1935 Paramount Pictures release, The Big Broadcast, of 1936 as a member of the Ray Noble Orchestra performing Why Stars Come Out at Night. Who's that?
Ethel Merman.
How about that? Get to these people here. The Big Broadcast of 1936 starred Bing Crosby, George Burns, Gracie Allen, Ethel Merman, Jack Oakey, that's to the left of Ethel, Bill Bojangles Robinson, and also featured other performances by Dorothy Dandridge and the Nicholas Brothers, who would appear with Miller again in two movies for the 20th Century Fox in 1941 and 1942. But then there were the hard times. In 1937, Glenn organized his own touring band and signed to Brunswick Records. There were a few recordings, one for Decca and one for Brunswick, a couple of week-long stints in New Orleans and Dallas, and many one-nighters, but it was not to be. Though the group would play one more date several days later in Bridgeport, Connecticut, Glenn gave his men their final notice on New Year's Eve at the Valencia Ballroom in York, Pennsylvania. Broke, depressed, and having no idea what he was going to do, he returned to New York City. Glenn Miller had compiled several musical arrangements, though. But the band failed to distinguish itself from the many others of the era, and they broke up in early 1938. Benny Goodman said in 1976, quote, "In late 1937, before his band became popular, we were both playing in Dallas. Glenn was pretty dejected and came to see me. He asked, 'Hey, Benny, what do you do? How do you make it?' I said, 'I don't know, Glenn. You just stay with it.'" Discouraged, Miller returned to New York City. He realized that he needed to develop a unique sound and decided to make the clarinet play a melodic line with a tenor saxophone holding the same note while three other saxophones harmonized within a single octave. George Simon discovered a saxophonist named Wilbur Schwartz for Glenn Miller. Miller hired Schwartz, but instead had him play the lead clarinet. According to Simon, "Willie's tone and way of playing provided a fullness and richness so distinctive that none of the later Miller imitators could ever accurately reproduce the Miller sound. With this new sound combination, Glenn Miller found a way to differentiate his band style from the many bands that existed in the late 1930s. Miller talked about his style in the May 1939 issue of Metronome Magazine. Quote, "You'll notice today some bands use the same trick on every introduction. Others repeat the same musical phrase as a modulation into a vocal. We're fortunate in that our style doesn't limit us to be stereotyped intros, modulations, first choruses, endings, or even trick rhythms. The fifth sax, playing clarinet most of the time, lets you know whose band you're listening to. And that's about all there is to it." It is said that Miller could never remember precisely the moment he decided to emphasize his new reed section sound. But it was during this disheartening interim that he realized the unique sound produced by the clarinet holding the melodic line while the tenor sax plays the same note and supported harmonically by three other saxophones just might be the individual and easy recognizable style that would set his band apart from all the rest. I'm not a musician, so I can't talk to that, but I'm sure there are some musicians in this room. So, formed in 1938 in March, the second Glenn Miller Orchestra, which would later include the likes of Tex Beneke, Marion Hutton, Ray Eberly, Paul Tanner, Johnny Best, Hal McIntyre, and Al Klink, soon began breaking attendance records up and down the East Coast. Yep. Tex Beneke right there. Marion Hutton. At the New York State Fair in Syracuse, it attracted the largest dancing crowd in the city's history. The next night, it topped Guy Lombardo's all-time record at the Hershey Park Ballroom in Pennsylvania. The orchestra was invited by ASCAP to perform at Carnegie Hall with three of the greatest bands ever, Paul Whiteman, Fred Waring, and Benny Goodman, and created more of a stir than any of them. Then came the big break. In September 1938, the Miller Band began making recordings for the RCA Victor Bluebird Records subsidiary. Charlie Cy Shribman, a prominent East Coast businessman, began financing the band, providing a much-needed infusion of cash. In the spring of 1939, the band's fortunes improved with a date at the Meadowbrook Ballroom in Cedar Grove, New Jersey, and more dramatically, at the Glen Island Casino in New Rochelle, New York. A breakout performance. The Glen Island date, according to author Gunther Schuller, attracted a record-breaking opening crowd of 1,800 people. Has anybody heard of Gunther Schuller? My wife is his personal assistant. That's why he lives in Newton. Won Grammy Awards. Yes?
He's in charge of one of the music schools in Boston.
That's correct. Yes, he... he's in all... plays all throughout the world. Very well-known jazz composer. Yes. So with the Glen Island date, the band began a huge rise in its popularity. In 1939, Time magazine noted, of the 12 to 24 discs in each of today's 300,000 U.S. jukeboxes, from 2 to 6 are usually Glenn Miller's. 1939, chart toppers, 17 top 10 hits, including Sunrise Serenade, Moonlight Serenade, Wishing We'll Make It So. Chart toppers also, like Stairway to the Stars, Moon Love, Over the Rainbow, Blue Orchids, The Man with the Mandolin. His Moonlight Serenade radio series for Chesterfield aired on CBS Radio 3 times a week. And now let's listen to Moonlight Serenade. Classic sounding, isn't it? Back when times were easy, there was a thing called trust, which is no longer in the American vocabulary. Neighbors knew neighbors. And it was exciting to go into a department store, even more exciting as a child to go into a candy store. Knew someone who had sugar. So, we got more to come. Moon Love. Let's listen to that.
Another chart topper.
How many remember hearing this on the radio? I asked earlier who had seen Glenn Miller live. If you had seen Glenn Miller perform live, raise your hand again, please. Great. Where'd you see him, sir? Boston University. Well,
stage radio show for Camels, I think it was.
For Camels. Back when you could mention cigarettes and not get in trouble about it. Where'd you see him?
The Bradford Roof.
The Bradford Roof. Wow. And you saw him in Michigan. What town?
Detroit.
Oh, Detroit.
Outside of Detroit.
Wow, outside of Detroit. Great. And who else saw him? In Norm Beacon Park in Waltham? Wow. Anyone else? So, he was a star now. And from who's there to the right? We all know who those ladies are. Andrew's sisters. From 1939 to 1942, Miller's band was featured 3 times a week during a quarter-hour broadcast for Chesterfield Cigarettes on CBS Radio, first with the Andrew's sisters, and then on its own.
Are we going to go there? We're moments away from going there. Other singers with this orchestra, this is the slide I tried to get to when you asked me who was singing that, included Marion Hutton, I think that was Skip Nelson we heard, Ray Eberly, and to a smaller extent, Kay Starr, Ernie Caceres, Dorothy Clare, and Jack Lathrop. Pat Friday ghost sang with the Miller Band in their two films, Sun Valley Serenade and Orchestra Wives, with Lynn Barry lip-syncing. There's Lynn Barry, lower right-hand corner. She was a looker. In the Mood. Anybody in the mood? Well, it was a tune popularized in 1939 in one of the best-known arrangements of the big band era and of Glenn Miller's career. It topped the charts 1 year later and was featured in the 1941 movie Sun Valley Serenade. It opens with a now-famous sax section theme, and it's joined by trumpets and trombones after 13 counts. It has two main solo sections, a tenor flight solo in the most famous recording, between Tex Beneke and Al Klink, and a 16-bar trumpet solo. It is also famous for its ending. Let's listen to that.
You got it going on. That's right, Don. There you go.
Now, I've been told this has been on the radio, was on the radio all the time that year. Is that true? I was told also that one person told me this was on the radio when they interrupted for the Pearl Harbor announcement. A Sunday afternoon. In this politically correct society, remember the Japanese got what they deserved. I just want to say that. It's so unique, so melodic, unheard of its time, but the public, especially the youth and the teens, were so thirsty, and the people in their young 20s for this type of music. It's almost like I can equate this type of music to the way young people felt in the early 1960s when they heard the Beatles for the first time. That's the future. Now, some other big hits. Tuxedo Junction. There were record-breaking recordings such as Tuxedo Junction, which sold 115,000 copies in the first week. That's a lot. Miller's huge success in 1939 culminated with his band appearing at Carnegie Hall on October 6th with Paul Whiteman, Benny Goodman, and Fred Waring, and also the main attractions. Let's listen to this. No, no, it's not. It looks like it. It's actually in Alabama, a place called Tuxedo Junction.
It looks like the building at the corner of Belmont and Watertown.
I know exactly what you're talking about. The Watertown Savings Bank with a militant parking lot attendant who wags his finger if you try to park there. Here we go, Tuxedo Junction. Starts out low. His music varied so much with all the instruments, too. Bring it, ladies! Give me a time where you heard this, sir. Do you remember? I've heard it so many times. Does anybody ever remember when they heard Glenn Miller for the first time? I couldn't tell you when I heard it. Yeah, right. Tuxedo Junction sold 115,000 copies the first week. Pennsylvania's 65,000 was also released. There were 31 top 10 hits that year. Careless, When You Wish Upon a Star, Imagination, Fools Rush In, Where Angels Fear to Tread, Blueberry Hill, and The Woodpecker's Son. In the Mood and Tuxedo Junction were inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame. Let's listen to Pennsylvania 65,000. If you dial this number today, it would cost you $10 a minute. You don't want to know. So that number would be PE6-5000, right? I do remember my phone number in Dedham being DA6, Davis67012. So stardom, 1941, another big year for Glenn. Another 11 top 10 hits, including the movie that we spoke about, Sun Valley Serenade, and Chattanooga Choo Choo, a million seller. Number one hits included Song of the Volga Boatman, You and I, and Elmer's Tomb. On February 10th, 1942, RCA Victor presented Miller with the first gold record for Chattanooga Choo Choo. Chattanooga Choo Choo was performed by the Miller Orchestra, with the singers Gordon Tex Beneke, Paula Kelly, and the vocal group The Modern Heirs. Tea station. Thank you. 1942, 11 top 10 hits, and the third year as a top recording artist with American Patrol, one of my favorites, A String of Pearls, which we heard earlier, Moonlight Cocktail, Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree, with anyone else but me, and I've Got a Gal in Kalamazoo, which came from Miller's second film, Orchestra Wives. And now let's listen to I've Got a Gal in Kalamazoo. Yes, Kalamazoo is in the northern part of Michigan. Anybody seen the movie Orchestra Wives? And Don't Sit Under.
Yep.
There you go. Let's see if this works here. Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree with anyone else but me. I think I might have to go to my other file here for this guy. Yeah. He wanted to go out to restaurants, so as a disguise, he'd just remove his glasses so no one would recognize him.
Don't hold anyone on your knee. You better be true to me. You better be true to me. You better be true to me. Don't hold anyone on your knee. You're getting a third degree when you come marching home. You're on your own weather.
So another hit that Glenn had was American Patrol.
I won't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but you till you come marching home.
Here we go.
P-51.
Yeah. In theory, that plane wasn't in the sky when this song came out. Tell you what, though, it was all over the Germans once the Mustang showed up. Sounds a little like Apple Tree. Famous football. So now the war years. 1943, two more top 10 hits, including a number one, That Old Black Magic. And the band found great success, but at the peak of their career, Glenn decided to join the military. The United States had just entered into World War II, and Glenn believed that he could better serve his country as a part of the armed forces, giving up his $22,000 per week job. Just by saying that today is staggering. Imagine how much money that was back then. However, at age 38, he was too old for combat, and he was not immediately accepted by the Navy or the Army Air Force. Glenn didn't let this stop him. In August of 1942, he wrote a letter to the Army's Brigadier General, Charles Young, saying that he wanted to, quote, put a little more swing into the feet of our marching men and a little more joy into their hearts, and to be placed in charge of a modernized Army band. Glenn soon became part of the Army Specialist Corps with the rank of captain. And for the next year and a half, besides arranging music, Glenn created and directed his own 50-member band. His mission was morale building, bringing a touch of home to the troops, and modernizing military music. He was also a talented fundraiser and raised millions of dollars in war bond drives. He also attracted Air Corps recruits through his I Sustain the Wings weekly radio broadcasts. Here's Glenn going over to England, 1944. So he ranged for overseas duty for the band. Arriving in London, the band was quartered at 25 Sloane Street, an area in constant barrage by German V-1 buzz bombs in 1944. Glenn was immediately concerned for the band and its safety, and he made arrangements for the unit to move to new quarters in Bedford, England. The band moved on July 2, 1944, and the very next day, a buzz bomb landed in front of their old quarters, destroying the building and killing 100 people. So, a little bit of fate there, dodging a bullet. The Glenn Miller Army Air Force Band was extremely busy, and Glenn wrote home that in 1 month they played at 35 different bases while performing 40 radio broadcasts in their spare time. A show for the troops. In less than 1 year, the Glenn Miller Army Air Force Band engaged in over 800 performances. Of these, 500 were broadcasts heard by millions of people. There were more than 300 personal appearances, including concerts and dances, with a gross attendance of over 600,000. But Glenn was not to participate in the final 6 months of these activities. Now, what do you know about Glenn Miller? Well, his favorite author was Damon Runyon. Favorite book was the Bible. His favorite actors, Spencer Tracy and Olivia de Havilland. His big loves were trout fishing, playing baseball, listening to good music, sleep, and money. His pet hates were bad swing, early morning telephone calls. He liked to sleep from 4 a.m. to noon, and the phrase, goodbye now. His favorite quotation, the one he stated, was not from the Bible nor from Runyon, but from Duke Ellington. It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. And now he gets on board this plane. In the fall of 1944, the band was scheduled to be sent on a six-week tour of Europe and would be stationed in Paris, France during that time. Miller decided to go ahead in order to make the proper arrangement for the group's arrival. And so on December 15, 1944, Glenn Miller boarded a transport plane to Paris. And if you picked up the newspaper that day, the New York Times, you'd see the headline, Nazi push halted by air and ground blows. 6,500 planes pound foe in record assault. Americans bite deep into southern flank. What battle are we talking about here? Battle of the Bulge. That's right. It was a cold day on 15 December 1944 when Major Glenn Miller boarded a Norseman C-64 aeroplane. Since joining the war, the great American band leader's Army Air Force Band had been performing for Allied troops all over England. Now he was flying to Paris to make final arrangements to bring his musicians in for a Christmas concert for the Allied troops there. We were making inroads, pushing on to the Rhine and on to Berlin. The original plan was for manager Don Haynes to fly with Miller to Paris. However, fate interceded and sent a Lieutenant Colonel Norman Basil his way. Miller had bumped into him at an officer's mess at Milton East near Northampton on 14 December and had struck up a conversation with the officer. Basil happened to mention that he would be departing for Paris the next day from an RAF airfield at Twinwood Farm 2, and upon hearing of Miller's plans, offered him a seat on the plane. Miller gladly accepted and whiled away the night, eating dinner and playing poker with Haynes and Basil. The morning of 15 December found Bedford heavily fogged in. A concerned Haynes called up Basil to find out if the flight was still on. Basil assured him that by the time they took off after lunch, the fog would be gone. It was a bitterly cold day outside when Basil contacted pilot John Morgan, who confirmed that he would be arriving soon. Miller, who had been waiting in the car with Haynes, quipped that Morgan would fail to locate the field as it was 24 degrees Fahrenheit and even the birds were grounded. He was forced to eat his words minutes later when an aircraft appeared through the dense fog and landed on the airstrip. The trio left the control tower and drove to the Nordwind Norseman C-64 airplane on the tarmac, where Morgan, waiting to take them, apologized for being late. Miller must have had some last-minute doubts about flying into the fog in the single-engine plane when he muttered, "Where the hell are the parachutes?" In a twist of irony, Basil replied, "What's the matter with you, Miller? Do you want to live forever?" Charles Lindbergh had made it across the whole Atlantic on one engine. Their C-64 would only be going as far as Paris. Miller made no further comment. Don Haynes watched as the Norseman sped down the runway and took to flight. He was the last person to see Glenn Miller alive. It's a map about where they think that Glenn Miller went down. It's generally considered this area, and we're going to talk about that area in just a moment. So what had exactly happened to the passengers of the Norseman has been the subject of much speculation for the past half a century. The official report was that the Norseman aircraft had crashed into the channel due to either iced over wings or engine failure. However, this explanation would prove unsatisfactory for the majority of the populace, thus causing multiple theories and speculations to mushroom over the years. 31. First theory. In 1985, British diver Clive Ward found what seemed to be the remains of the ill-fated Norseman off the coast of France. Aside from the ordinary corrosive effects of the sea, Ward found no damage to the plane and, more interestingly, no sign of the plane's registration number or human remains. This, 40 years later. This inevitably led to unanswered questions regarding the fates of Miller and the two other officers and encouraged even more speculation to spread. Theory one, Miller had survived and later died in a bordello. The most preposterous claim in this collection of tales is that Glenn Miller and the two officers had safely crossed the channel to Paris and had later died in somewhat compromising conditions. The theory was first put forth in 1997 by the German journalist Udo Ulfkott, who had trawled through American and German intelligence wartime efforts for a book on German intelligence agencies. According to the German tabloid magazine Bild, Ulfkott had supposedly found, among the many documents he had procured from the American government under the Freedom of Information Act, evidence of a steamy cover-up that Miller had actually arrived safely in Paris on 14 December, but had unfortunately met his end while in the dubious company of a French prostitute. Disputing this absurd claim, however, is retired Lieutenant Colonel Robert Baker, who reported to the Fort Worth Star-Telegram that there was no way Miller could possibly have reached Paris by 15 December, except on his flight, because the two of them had been drinking together in England the night before. Theory two, Miller had died of medical conditions in a hospital. There are two different claims made that Miller had in fact gone over the channel and back, but later died in an American hospital. One of the claims was put forth by the New Jersey Department of Health, which stated that Miller had died in Ohio in 1945 as a result of injuries. Dr. Chris Valenti, notorious for his Glenn Miller conspiracy theories, received an anonymous letter from an unnamed doctor who claimed that Miller had been flown in with gunshot wounds in 1945 and had later died under his care. Miller's younger brother, Herb, however, had a different story for the press. Breaking a nearly 40-year silence in 1983, Herb Miller claimed that Glenn Miller did not die in a plane crash over the channel, but from lung cancer in a hospital. Miller had apparently been shuttled off to a military hospital upon arrival, where cancer took his life the very next day. To support his story, Herb Miller had pointed out a passage in a letter written by his chain-smoking brother in the summer of 1944 that said, quote, "I am totally emaciated. Although I am eating enough, I have trouble breathing. I think I'm very ill." Miller's depression, irritability, and exhaustion during the few months prior to his untimely demise, Herb Miller asserted, further proved that Glenn Miller had an underlying medical condition. To further corroborate this story, Don Haynes, Miller's band manager, had claimed that the band leader had lost a lot of weight and that his tailor-made uniforms didn't fit him as well at all. They merely hung on him. Miller must have been aware of his impending doom, for late one night he told George Faustus, the director of his military programs, "You know, George, I have an awful feeling you guys are going to go home without me." Furthermore, according to weather report on 15 December, the daytime temperature had been 41 degrees Fahrenheit and not the previously claimed 24 degrees Fahrenheit, too warm for airplane wings to have iced over and crashed into the English Channel. Herb Miller was unable to furnish information about his brother's final resting place, claiming that Miller had probably been buried in a mass grave at some British military cemetery. True to his brother's heart, however, Herb had allegedly fabricated the crash story because his brother had wanted to die as a hero and not in a lousy bed. Theory number three, Miller's plane crashed due to bad weather. Why Glenn, who had such a real fear of airplanes, decided to risk a trip under such adverse conditions has never been determined. That according to his biographer, George Simon. The official report issued by the U.S. military on December 24th was that Miller's plane had nosedived into the English Channel either because its wings had iced over or due to engine failure. Supporting this claim is Fred W. Atkinson Jr., who in 1944 had been at Le Bourget Airport in Paris. Atkinson had been a member of the 320th Air Transport Squadron, which was a unit of Colonel Arnold's Air Transport Wing, and served as an experimental air evacuation squadron, specializing in the removal of wounded soldiers from field hospitals and the transportation of these men back to Paris. The aircraft assigned to them were Norseman airplanes, similar to the doomed one, chosen because they were small enough to land on roadways, fields, or even open spaces. There were, however, two drawbacks to these planes. They had no navigation instruments and were grounded in bad weather conditions, information that would later be crucial to explaining the fate of Miller's plane. According to Atkinson, two of the C-64 Norsemen were scheduled to return to Paris on the day Miller departed from London. However, the flights were canceled on account of bad weather. In spite of the risk involved, an unnamed brigadier general ordered that two pilots fly Miller into Paris to regroup with his band, who had arrived earlier. When Atkinson's unit left for Paris several days later, they were notified of a crashed aircraft on the coast of France that might belong to the unit and whose occupants were dead. A plane was dispatched, and its crew identified the bodies as those of Miller and the two pilots based on identification papers and dog tags, as well as visual identification. The second crew in London further verified that Miller and the two pilots had been seen to depart in the crashed aircraft several days earlier, as we mentioned. So papers detailing the salvage of the crashed aircraft were processed, as well as the report of the deaths of the pilots on the squadron morning report, which was updated on a daily basis to keep track of the status of all personnel. Because of the loss of the pilots and the Army's number one morale man, there were rumors that officers in the 320th Squadron had sworn to bring manslaughter charges against the Brigadier General who had issued the order. However, as Miller had not yet been officially pronounced dead, they could do little but wait in frustration until the announcement was made. Unfortunately, for Atkinson's unit, there was never a conclusion to all this, despite the surplus of witnesses to confirm the events. Now the disappearance. Theory four, that Miller's plane was downed by friendly fire. And I support this theory. Currently, the most highly debated theory regarding the disappearance of Glenn Miller was that his plane had been the victim of friendly fire. The late Fred Shaw was the navigator of a Lancaster, serial number NF973, based in Methwold, England. On the day Miller's plane disappeared, 138 Lancaster bombers, they're British bombers, one of them Shaw's, were returning home from an aborted bombing raid on Saigon in Germany because their fighter escorts had failed to get off the ground. Because the squadron could not possibly land with their staggering bomb load, their combined total of 100,000 incendiary bombs had to be jettisoned, as was standard procedure. The bomb jettison zone was known as the South Jettison Area, a 10-mile circle 50 miles south of Beachy Head over the English Channel, and was officially dangerous grounds to be avoided by all aircraft and ships. When the bombs were jettisoned from a safety height of 4,000 feet, Shaw, who had never seen a bombing before, was driven by curiosity to look out the window. As the bombs exploded several feet above the surface of the sea, he saw a plane 2,500 feet below flying south. Years later, he would say, "It was obvious to me that the aeroplane below was in trouble, so I watched intently. Then, just before it went out of sight, under the leading edge of the wing, I saw it flick over to port in what looked like an incipient spin, and eventually I saw it disappear into the English Channel." The bomb aimer had reported the same sighting a moment before, and now a rear gunner called over the intercom that there's a kite just gone in, down under. Because they were technically not in enemy territory and the mission had been reported, the men were not debriefed and the downed plane remained unreported. Makes sense. Shaw never connected the downed plane with Glenn Miller's mysterious disappearance until 1956, when he saw the movie The Glenn Miller Story, starring Jimmy Stewart. He had decided on impulse to check his old logbook and realized that the Norseman he'd been seen plunging into the sea could very well have been Miller's. When Shaw first came out with the story, the public's initial response, especially that of the Glenn Miller Appreciation Society, was to dismiss him as a publicity seeker. Then a hail of awkward questions descended. How could it be proven that Miller's plane had strayed into the path of the Lancasters when John Morgan had even failed to register a flight path? How was Shaw able to recognize a Norseman when there were only a half dozen of these Canadian planes in Britain, all of them in American air bases? And what about that 1 hour time discrepancy? Well, let's just tackle the questions here. The British Defense Ministry's Air Historical Branch decided to investigate the claim and recruited a man named Roy Nesbitt, who spent years researching the problem. Here are his findings. How could Miller's plane have strayed into a jettison zone? Well, the Norseman had no option but to take the SHAEF, the SHAEF, that's the shuttle path, the route employed by the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Forces to France. Despite all the anti-aircraft emplacements on the southeast coast, a route had been cleared for flights. Unfortunately, this brought Miller's plane perilously close to the jettison area, which was only a few miles away from the SHAEF path. Because John Morgan was inexperienced in flying by instruments, he most likely would have used a compass, which was notoriously unreliable, especially if the pilot was navigating an area without landmarks, and in this case, it was fatal. Why was there a 1 hour discrepancy in time? Well, that's because the Americans used Greenwich Mean Time, where the British used their own time. That's the hour difference. What about recognizing such a rare airplane? Well, Shaw had answered this question himself. He took navigator training in Canada, in Manitoba, and he had seen this type of aircraft before, so he knew what it was. Question number four. Victor Gregory, who had captained Shaw's plane, responded to the mail. An author had now written to anybody that was in that plane or that bomber group on that day of December 15, 1944. And Victor Gregory responds, thinking it's a reunion. And he says, he himself had not witnessed the bombing of the plane. However, he recalled that the bombardier had spotted the plane and called the navigator over to take a look. Soon after, Fred Shaw had identified the airplane as a Norseman. So he said he didn't come forward because when we got back from that raid, it was an aborted raid. So we didn't go into our normal debriefing. Don't think me unsympathetic or callous, but when I heard of the plane going down, I would have said that he shouldn't have been there. Forget him. My own concern was getting my own airplane home safely, and we were fighting a war, and we lost thousands of planes. We had some pretty grim air raids after that, and they didn't announce Miller's death until later. It had gone completely from my mind. And there was a separate investigation carried out by the Air Historical Branch in England. And they looked back into the records about that raid on the rail yards at Steig in Germany. And the records confirmed that the force had to be recalled because they didn't have fighter covered. And this is before they entered German airspace. So, anyways, the Ministry of Defense writes to Fred Shaw, and they corroborated his story, saying that you were in the right place at the right time. the situation that you described would have fit in with our military records. And basically, the only RAF connection at that time was that it had taken off from an airfield at Twinwood Farms, Bedfordshire, in weather conditions which could be described as marginal. And your story, sir, to a great extent changed this, and we carried out an investigation earlier this year into the aborted bomber operation of 15 December 1944. And basically, to cut through all this jargon here, they believed that Shaw's documents were authentic, and eventually they were eventually sold at auction for 22,000 British pounds. So, the logbook of another pilot who accompanied that bomber raid, Derek Thurman, he had written that when the bombs were away, three crew members on board his plane had spotted a light aircraft below, which seemed to have been downed by the hail of explosives. The bomb aimer saw it first from the nose, and he commented on it, whereupon the navigators shot out of his seat to the side to have a look, and he saw the plane whip by. Seconds later, the rear gunner called in to say, "It's gone, it flipped over, gone in." So what you have here, folks, is you have separate corroborations of bombs that were let go by bomber groups in a designated area, and the plane, the C-64 Norseman, that Glenn Miller happened to be traveling in, was in the wrong place at the wrong time and strayed into this area due to fog and bad weather. Of course, there are other theories which said that he had been a spy and had subsequently had to be killed, or that he was a victim of black marketers, or that he was marked for death because he was threatening to expose a cabal of gay U.S. officers, or that he had accidentally been shot by an MP in Paris, or that a German assassination squad had been sent to shoot down his plane, or that he had been abducted by aliens who apparently had been interested in studying and dissecting him. Yeah, that's a close one too, yeah? So anyways, his obituary showed up in the New York Times. Major Glenn Miller is missing on a flight from England to Paris. Never forget, Glenn Miller will be remembered for many things: his musical style, his showmanship, hard work, perseverance, and much more. But his patriotism and giving up his number one civilian band to enlist in the United States Army Air Corps, his pioneering efforts to modernize military bands, and the supreme sacrifice for his country have caused him to be remembered as Clarinda's and America's favorite musical patriot. That's my talk for tonight. Thank you so much. God bless you. Any questions, comments about Glenn Miller on about hearing? Yes.
Glenn Miller never married, right?
He did marry.
He did.
Yes, he did. Yes. Do you remember hearing about him? Yes, Helen. Do you remember hearing the story about him going missing on the radio, and was it heartbreaking? Yeah.
That he was missing.
That he was missing. Right. Yeah. Yeah, and it was where we had started to take control of World War II, and we were marching on Berlin and moving. We'd just gotten the upper hand, the Battle of the Bulge, Hitler's last move. But I had one person tell me that that he remembered when he heard that the day the music died, when Buddy Holly, the Big Bopper, and Ritchie Valens crashed. And I always wanted to get your take on what you heard when Glenn Miller disappeared. Any other fond memories of Glenn Miller's music or during the time? Any comments before we go?
That was part of our life when we were young.
Yeah. And it's okay to go back there every once in a while.
Look how many bands have copied his style since.
Oh, sure. Sure.
He was the best.
And that's why he's made a resurgence in the last 10 years. His records are being discovered by an entirely new generation, and being enjoyed by an entirely new generation, being studied by musicians of today. So thank you very much. I'm going to be here back next month with the Great Hurricane of 1938. Have a great Memorial Day weekend. Thank you.